episode of the Media Briefing Podcast, news, views and more from around the media industry. My name is Chris Sutcliffe and I'm the news editor for the Media Briefing.
And I'm Esther Kazaya, I'm the digital content executive.
Later this episode, we're going to be hearing from Simon Davies of Quartz, asking how a business-focused international publication like Quartz builds new products.
But we're going to start with a roundup of the top stories from last week, so you can start your week completely up to date. This is still in the rumour mill, but Facebook is allegedly, according to Business Insider, working on a new feature that will showcase lists of curated content from publishers directly into the newsfeed. So this kind of collections feature is basically another feature of Snapchat. It's going to look a bit like Snapchat Discover.
I constantly hear people saying that Facebook is doing all it can to undercut Snapchat Discover.
Yeah.
And this makes sense for them. This is a way that they can sort of hold on to publishers' content, make it appear to be quality, premium, and charge more for advertising against it. It's a smart business move. You know, whatever we think of Facebook here, you can't see, but I'm doing the thumbs down. it is a smart business move.
Yeah, I think that this will help address a lot of those issues with fake news, even because, I mean, Snapchat managed to avoid all of that because everything that goes on there is so heavily moderated.
Yeah, we mentioned that in the last podcast.
Yeah.
It's interesting that we've known for a while that Google and Facebook are working on tools to really grapple with, you know, the fake news problem. Fake news as a definition is kind of unhelpful, but yeah, I think everyone knows what we're talking about here. We're talking about malign, deliberately misleading content that just gets put out there for the sake of, you know, garnering ad dollars.
Yeah. So, I mean, at the moment, if you publish on Facebook, you have to, your story will only reach us however many organic followers you have, and even then ends up being like a small percentage of that, and you then go into Facebook's kind of boosting system in order to boost to more people, which often is boosting to your own subscribers, which seems mental. But anyway, so Facebook have promised, apparently with these early collection partners, that the content they create will actually be inserted into the newsfeed, regardless of whether users like the page or not.
That's interesting. That is very, very similar to Snapchat Discover, as we mentioned before. This should help a relationship with publishers, even though so obviously there's reticence among a lot of publishers in going into Facebook because it's an unsafe environment. Their content is currently treated exactly the same as everything else. In fact, there are indications that it is deprioritized compared to friends and family content. So this seems smart. If you've read the latest Reuters Institute look at digital-born media in Europe, a lot of those editors in chiefs, they look at Facebook as this huge opportunity, you know, despite all those problems. And so this really feels like that's only going to push that relationship further.
Yeah. And it is perhaps good that Facebook are actually finally having this direct kind of relationship, and it will hopefully improve that relationship with publishers, although jury's out.
Yeah. And however, it's unclear whether Facebook will share any of that increased ad revenue with publishers or even offer publishers an option to monetize that themselves. You would expect that they would. In fact, I'm kind of willing to bet on it, but it's one of those details that needs to be hashed out. I said early days. So if you're in print, this has been another good week. Oh no, wait.
Raconteur magazine has folded suddenly after 8 months. I feel like we're bringing up another closure every single week on this podcast.
We should have it as a regular feature.
How much trouble would we get in?
A lot. We would get an awful lot of kickback. But I will write a jingle, and then at least it will be very lighthearted when we're talking about all these people losing their jobs.
Okay. The UK's first free monthly current affairs magazine. It launched in March last year. A lot of people said, you know, this is going to be the next big thing. It's aimed at a millennial audience who are interested in quality news.
I think that in retrospect, it's always, you know, hindsight is 2020. It's an awful situation for a lot of people involved. But it is kind of funny hearing what editor Freddie Osberg said at the time. He said that far from being dead, print is live, kicking, and earning. And flash forward, what, from March to now?
Yeah,
and so nearly found.
Yeah, 8 months.
Yeah. So the new current statement.
So Osberg has now said, you know, we stubbornly kept going all year, despite the advertising revenue not being there. And we finally have to accept that it's a distraction we can no longer afford. The market is there for London free sheets, but we just weren't good enough this time. So he's kind of almost saying, well, it's not a problem with the industry or the market, it's the problem with us and us just not being good enough, which doesn't quite seem right.
But it really does seem like the bottom is continuing to fall out of the print advertising model.
Yeah. And it seems particularly for these free sheets that, yes, that they might sort of be able to distribute at mass scale, but do they, like people have said, well, do they actually really know their audience? Do they know who their audience is? Whereas luxury magazines, and they know exactly who they're aimed at.
Absolutely. And there's a fantastic quote from the editor, Peter Guest, if you just want to close off that section with that quote.
Apparently, print media is dead and someone only just told the CEO.
Well, writing's on the wall.
Mic drop. But it's not all bad news for print. Johnson Press want to create a brand for the weekend, according to The Drum.
Yeah, so it would... I mean, their thinking is that the current premium titles like The Sunday Times, The Sunday Telegraph and The Observer kind of reign unchallenged.
Yeah, perhaps for good reason. You know, the amount of resource required to produce a weekend edition is huge. I mean, these companies have whole departments dedicated to that.
That's true, but it could almost be seen as a tentpole for what Johnson is trying to do with the IE, to make it this umbrella title for a lot of the regional content.
Yeah.
You know, they have all this content already. I don't think it's necessarily the worst idea in the world. You know, if they can take even a small proportion of the ad revenue of the readers away from those, you know, the big three, I think this might not necessarily work, but at least be something to tide them over until they come up with the next big idea. Hmm. You don't seem convinced.
No, I'm not convinced. I think the culture of people who read things like that at the weekend is, you know, it's big, it's solid, but it's not growing.
Mm.
And to try and launch into that kind of space where people are already going to be very loyal to these papers is not a great idea.
I suppose as well that what people actually want from their Sunday papers is, in a lot of cases, the supplements.
Yeah.
And so at the moment, we don't quite know what the supplement for this weekend eye would be.
Ashley Highfield has said that, you know, you get these weekend editions and they're often four or five times the size of the ones during the week. And he thinks that there is an appetite for a paper that is kind of this same kind of snackable content. It doesn't overload. You can read it all the way through rather than throwing half of it away for the supplements.
I'm turning around on this idea. Now I'm a little bit more negative. That's very much the same messaging we saw with The New Day, which, yeah. You know, let me just turn to my copy here. Oh, I can't because it's not in print anymore. That's worrying.
Yeah, and that basically is their proposition, is that they're going to launch almost like a metro style thing. That they've said they want to target the millennials on the night buses at weekends.
Mm.
To which you just think, hang on.
Wait, what? No, I'm completely turned around on this. The only thing people need print, like newspapers for at the weekend on the night buses, is to mop up the vomit. That's not like, people aren't reading it for news content.
There is going to be an incoming TMB smackdown on this topic later next week.
But without the IE, Johnston Press's figures would have been down sort of 16% instead of the 4% posting its latest results. So the IE is still a very big brand for it. It's still a valuable title.
Yeah.
And honestly, apart from all the problems we've just listed, I kind of think it's heartening to see them really doubling down on this idea that the IE is a quality product that they're willing to put resources into and to fund.
Yeah, and I mean they've had a 4% sales uplift for the IE. They say themselves that there are still problems getting brand recognition in the shadow of kind of the independent clothes and things, but they're not doing badly.
I can understand that. Yeah, it will inevitably always be shackled in a lot of people's minds to the indie. It is. It's a very, very interesting title. I guess we'll just have to see how this weekend edition goes.
Yeah, and also that's just confirmed that they're just kind of exploring that space at the moment. They've not said that they will not definitely launch there.
Okay, that could be interesting. We'll keep an eye on it. So earlier this week, we spoke to Simon Davies from Quartz, and I was interested to find out how Quartz, which is this huge international business site, you know, it's been going 4 years now. It's built out a suite of products, including Atlas and its own Quartz app, which we talk about. And I was really interested to see how this digital startup, a spin-off of The Atlantic, goes about building those products, where the conception is, and how ultimately it gets delivered. So just recently you were given, in fact it was announced yesterday, you were given $240,000 in funding by Knight Foundation to really concentrate on the Quartz Boss Studio. What was the sort of thinking behind that? I know it's building off stuff you've done with sort of the Quartz app.
Yes. Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So we've already been fairly early, or recognized to be fairly early with the adoption of a chatbot. It looks like a chatbot, it's not really a chatbot. But the idea of having delivering the news through a conversational interface, as we did with the app which we launched earlier this year, got a lot of plaudits, surprised a lot of people. And has been really successful since then. It's not a true bot. It doesn't really use AI. It's written by our journalists. So you're effectively you're not having a, it's not a chatbot, you're having a conversation with our newsroom about how you want to hear the news that day. We have also used, we had an experiment with Slack. We put together essentially a concierge service for our next billion conference in San Francisco. So we've started using some bot-like AI-related technologies in some of the ways in which we deliver news and service our readers. The grant is going to give us an opportunity to dig further, to figure out the opportunities that bots, AI, other related technologies offer us as a provider of news to better service people. And as people continue to adopt different platforms and so forth, what are the best ways to do that? It's pretty quartzy in that there's no commercial imperative behind it.
Right.
It's there to figure out and to experiment and to explore what are the best practices for these technologies, and then share that as well. So we'll open source mode for findings as well.
Mm-hmm. No, fantastic. And it's interesting in that you say it's very quartzy and that there's almost at this moment no commercial aspect to it, because we've seen a lot of people who are sort of investing in bots are on, you know, from the brand side of things,
mm-hmm.
and they are explicitly almost recommendation engines to lead customers down this, you know, this journey towards a purchase. So, I mean, do you have any idea what you want to do with this grant? How you actually want to approach it from this quartzy way, as you say?
You've seen some of the statements from Zach, who's our head of product. It's a genuine exploration. We don't know. We have no real expectations about what the output will be. And if you're able to free up those people that are involved in and within that studio from that pressure to either drive to a purchase or even, you know, drive to one of our other products, if you free them up and say, find out the best way to interact with people, to inform people, and we will then share the learnings and take the learnings ourselves as a news organization in whatever way we will, we end up with a better product that people want to engage with.
So that's almost the complete opposite to the approach that somebody like The Economist might take, where they set out quite a clear indicator at the start about what something's got to achieve. Do you think that sort of gives you an advantage? Like, are you able to be a lot more flexible in the way you sort of almost play with this technology?
I don't know about an advantage, because, you know, our business model is our business model, and this way suits us very well. How The Economist do it wouldn't suit us, but it suits them very well. So I'm not sure if it's an advantage from a business perspective. It's just how we've done things in the past. And that has led to success as a business.
I see. And you mentioned earlier in the sort of positive history of Quartz that, you know, it's all in service of this idea of this editorial idea that, you know, change is rampant and, as you said, it's sort of sweeping west to east. So what sort of led to the development of these bots? What was the conversation behind it? Did you sort of see what your editorial team was writing about, or was it sort of based on just what you were seeing elsewhere?
It's what you're seeing elsewhere. It's also, you don't want to be behind the people that you seek to serve. And often, and I've seen, and you'll have been at the same sort of conferences I will be, where people will talk about moving readers to a certain way of experiencing things. And the truth is, actually, they already get there before you do, as you're desperately trying often to catch up. Bots and AI and related technologies are very much off the moment. People are talking, lots of people are developing bots of varying qualities. It gives us, as a grant, it gives us the opportunity to take a pause and figure out actually what is the best way to implement these.
But I mean, this is, Bot Studio is far from the only new product or sort of new service that you've been launching recently. Just looking back over the last year, I'm thinking about Atlas and sort of all these new sets of products. So, I mean, what has been sort of the journey over the past year when it comes to developing these new products? What's the almost the kernel, the starting point for all of them?
The kernel and the starting point for all of them is an editorial drive. So from the start, when we launched Quartz, very soon after we launched Quartz, we also launched the Daily Brief, which is a morning newsletter, that was our first brand extension apart from qz.com. And that's had tremendous success, but it came from the idea that a newsletter could be more than a way to drive a product purchase or drive people to a website so you can serve them an ad. That if you treat something as a genuine service that adds value in and of itself, people enjoy it, they want to receive it. We have 250,000 subscribers to the Daily Brief, the open rates about 48%.
Wow.
It comes...
An involuntary wow there from somebody who has to do a newsletter every now and then.
That's taken time. That's taken a way to build up trust, and that's taken an understanding between us and the people that have given us permission to be in their inbox, that we are there to provide a service, and that, in the case of the Daily Brief, is to give them everything that they're going to need to know in order to set them up for a successful day.
So I think generally as an industry, a lot of people now regarded newsletters as something they just sort of tack on to the end of their strategy. So would you say that there was sort of real value in newsletters in your strategy?
Yeah, and Chris just mentioned that there's been a lot going on, and two of our most recent product launches have also been newsletters. Mm. There's a true value that they offer. So one is Quartzy, which is put together by our global lifestyle editor, Jenny Avins, and that's about how to live well in the global economy. It's a weekly newsletter, and it's covered everything from Brazilian graffiti art to the theory of deliciousness and so forth. And most recently, I'm going to do my Spanish accent.
Do it.
La Agenda, which is a Spanish language version of the Daily Brief, our first non-English language product that we've developed since launch, and essentially modelled entirely on the Daily Brief. So newsletters have always been, since the early days, and remain a really important and valuable part of what Quartz offers.
So why launch the Spanish language newsletter? Presumably that was based on audience demographics at this point.
Yeah, it's in terms of audience demographics, you'll see that if you look on the Jour and the data, the one area that we haven't perhaps succeeded as rapidly as we would like to do is in South America. And this is a part of an exploration into, is there an audience for Quartz, and if so, who is it? An audience for Quartz in South America, and who is it? What do they enjoy reading, and how can we better service them? We don't know. We can only anticipate and experiment with the idea that perhaps the language is the primary barrier. We'll find out.
All in service of experimentation at that point.
All in service of experimentation.
But these product launches aren't just a one and done phenomenon. You then have to go back and tweak and sort of look at how existing services are going. So if we take Atlas, for instance, that's been going since, what, June of last year?
Yeah.
So what is Atlas, and what is it now, over a year after it was launched?
So the Atlas is a home for data visualization and charts. We do a lot of charts, of course, and we found if we look at the evidence, and stories that have a chart attached to them are twice as likely to be shared and so on.
People also love charts.
People do love charts. You may have heard many times our editor-in-chief, Kevin Delaney, has called charts cat photos for business people. They love to share them. But there's a very good reason for that. It's like this audience that we serve are really busy, but they need a lot of information. The chart's a fantastic way to give people an understanding of sometimes very complex issues in a short amount of time. And so when we're producing that amount of charts, we produce about 6,000 in a couple of years. It seems sensible that actually they become a resource in themselves. They deserve a home. And actually that becomes a resource for other people, whether they be researchers, academics, people wanting to put a sales deck together, whoever they are. So the idea came about that these charts themselves could become a destination rather than just part of individual stories. So that was the kernel of the idea. We also thought it would be great to invite other companies, other institutions, researchers to also contribute to Atlas and increase the volume of content that people could find there. So we started initially with inviting a select number of people to become contributors. You could register, we had to go through an approval process. Fake news is very nasty, we didn't want fake charts either. And from there, most of the focus has been on increasing the amount of people that are registered, increasing the amount of people that, increasing the amount of volume of content that they've been putting up there. And we've had, you know, everybody, the UK Houses of Parliament are registered and regularly put charts on Atlas now. So it's started to develop a life of its own.
So it wasn't a sort of, it wasn't a big launch initially, and then a sort of tail.
The next evolution of Atlas is to get even greater involvement from those people that are registered. So the initial wave, if you like, for Atlas and the outreach was to make people aware of it, to get people to see it for what it could be and a resource for them to upload the information that they have, as well as search for information they may be looking for. The next part of that engagement with people is to encourage further uploads, to see it as the place that is the, one of the primary places they should be seeding this information with once they've created it. And so that's the process we're going through now, is to get more content from those people who are registered.
And just this very sort of simple explanation, how does that support Quartz's editorial remit? How does it sort of, how does it support the, you know, the mission to inform about the global business economy?
Charts, as we've learned from launch, are truly valued by those that people that we're speaking to. So those people who are engaged in the global business economy, those people who are senior in whatever job it is that they do, in whatever industry they find themselves in. To have a place where people know they can go to, where if they're looking for the cost of housing in Brazil, if they're that they can go there, then it becomes of inherent value of itself, above and beyond a place for us and our journalists to place charts once they're created.
But in and of itself, then the Atlas doesn't necessarily have a sort of a commercial proposition. It's in support of this overall strategy now.
It wasn't launched because we had a commercial goal for it, but there are ways we integrate with partners. We launched with GE, and we have an ongoing, very positive relationship with GE, and the Atlas fitted a lot of the communication and marketing messages they have. So we've created charts that talk about a lot of the data they have. We also can seed in partner-created charts as well. So there's ways in which we have created commercial success from the Atlas, but it wasn't launched in order to make money.
How does that compare then to the news app, which was presumably launched at least with an idea that it would be commercially viable product in its own right? How's the development different there?
This is part of what I enjoy about working at Quartz, is that at the beginning of the inception of a lot of products we're talking about that we've launched outside of QZ.com, which still remains the commercial the engine of Quartz. I'm not even in the room. These experiments are born out of editorial imperatives. They're born out of behaviors that they're seeing or thirst for knowledge in certain areas that they're seeing amongst people who are coming to trust Quartz as a news outlet.
So what is the almost, how do you build this idea of innovation and building up these new editorial products into workflow? Do you have regular meetings where you almost sit down and go, hey, we spotted that we can be doing something else here? Is it actually built into, you know, the monthly schedule almost?
So we meet a lot, Quartz, and we converse a lot, and doesn't sound the easiest thing when you have a team that's split between New York, London, San Francisco, Hong Kong, but we make use of things like Slack, we use BlueJeans a lot, and we also use Trello as a way of tracking project development, and So we are constantly talking about what each other are doing, and we're aware of them, and we can start to build them into the writing's workflows as and when appropriate. Mm-hmm. And we can also start to feedback where we think and what we're hearing in the market is going to potentially be of interest.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that sounds incredibly, you know, having spoken to people who've worked with other publishers, that sounds incredibly freeing, this idea that, you know, these ideas can almost be generated organically rather than, you know, we have this dedicated 6-month review period and you better come with ideas and they better be commercially viable off the bat. It sounds like it's kind of a very, almost an enviable position to be in.
It's enviable in a lot of ways, but I don't want to misrepresent it. You know, we have revenue targets. We have a growth trajectory to keep up. We have an owner who we need to use. Loyalty we should reward, and so we do have very, very real commercial pressures. What is freeing though is knowing that having the types of processes we've put in place, and we must ensure as we grow remain central to what Quartz is and what Quartz does, that there will be additional resource, there'll be additional product. The products we have will continue to evolve in positive ways that engender engagement, that reach new users, that allow us to meet those commercial goals.
So I guess then, just as a final question, what is the last book you've actually been reading that's kind of really affected the way you think?
This is a really timely interview because, I mean, prior to this last week, I could count the number of leadership or business books I'd completed on the thumbs of one hand, but I'm actually just reading and really enjoying Legacy by James Kerr, which is it's a great book for a couple of reasons. It's a great leadership book. First, it's about the All Blacks, so yeah,
I'm a rugby fan.
Yeah, you got to, just when you might be slightly tiring of the leadership anecdotes, you get a story from the 2011 World Cup final, which has kept me going. But it's and another way, he also draws on a lot of other great leadership books to give you further lessons through it. But the heart of it, what I'm really enjoying, you know, we're a business in transition. We're no longer a startup. We're a recognized news brand, yet we are, you know, we're 200 people, we're not 2,000 people. So we're in an interesting stage of transition. So it's a perfect time to be reading something like this. And what he goes back to, or what I'm getting out of it, whether he meant it or not, was that the secrets of not just winning, but leaving a legacy behind are humility and honesty and constant learning. And those are things that, that I hope we can leave at the heart of Quartz.
In addition to the articles we publish every day on themediabriefing.com and this podcast and our webinars and our events, we also deliver a daily newsletter direct to your inbox. It contains essential daily briefings about everything going on in the media, plus our most read stories from around the industry.
And registration is also now open for the Media Briefing's flagship conference, Digital Media Strategies 2017. That takes place on the 20th to the 23rd of February in London next year. You'll get to meet us.
Yay!
Yo.
And that's kind of our big key event for addressing a lot of the issues we talk about here. The agenda and the initial speakers have now been announced, so if you want to see if that takes your fancy, you can go to digital-media-strategies.com.
Entries are now also open for the 2017 British Media Awards. These awards return on the 3rd of May next year, honouring media organisations across 19 categories, recognising excellence across vast swathes of the media industry. From commercial to editorial, from print to digital, those judging panels and categories are now announced at BritishMediaAwards.com. Entries close on the 27th of January, so you should start working on your entries now.
Yeah. And finally, this podcast is made for you guys. If you've got things you like, dislike, or want to hear us talk about, or
if
not talk about.
If you've got guests you want to suggest.
Yeah, you
know,
guests you want to suggest.
If you've got any themes you want us to include, any, you know, yeah. We were talking before about including a section just on print closures. If you want to suggest any sections to us, please go ahead.
Or if you don't want us to mention any more print closures, then just get in touch with us.
Yeah, if you want us to stick our heads in the sand, fantastic, we can do that.
So you can get a hold of me on esther.kizaya@briefingmedia.com.
And I'm chris.sutcliffe@briefingmedia.com, or you can find me on Twitter @chrismsutcliffe.
And I'm also on Twitter @estherkizayah, or follow @mediabrief.
We've got a particularly good podcast coming up next week, so come back, stick around. We'll be here basically forever, I think.
Hey!
Is that overconfidence? Are we tempting fate?
Only if one of us dies in a bus crash or something.
Okay, fantastic. So we'll see you guys next time, unless one of us dies in a bus crash.